Hello. It's January 16th, 2025. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are having a, are preparing for a good weekend. Excuse me there. And before we begin our story today, I do want to go ahead and say listener's discretion is advised because towards the end of the story, it does talk about suicide. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1993, and in the bustling and vibrant city of San Francisco, California, which had a population of around 700,000 at that time, this city was known for many fun things. For one, San Francisco was known for its wide array of museums that housed some of the most beautiful artwork the world had ever seen. And many of these museums' exteriors were a sight to see as well. Also, San Francisco was known for its music and nightlife scenes, which included partygoers jamming out to their favorite band at places like the Fillmore, catching a concert at the Opera House or Symphony, or maybe catching a show at the American Conservatory Theater. San Francisco, though, was known for more than just its arts, because many people from around the world thought that most people who lived here had a great vibe and were very friendly. However, in the summer of 1993, one person who lived in the area didn't possess any good vibes. He was mad at the world and wanted to take it out on anyone who stood in his way. And when he did, he would destroy several lives and leave a stain on San Francisco's history due to his carnage. In the following case, you'll find out who the man was, the heinous act he committed, the investigation, and aftermath in a case I title, Caught in the Crossfire. On the afternoon of July 1st, 1993, it was a typical San Francisco afternoon, as many people were carrying on with their daily routines, and some tourists were snapping away at their cameras to take in much of the beautiful scenery the city had to offer. On the sidewalks of the city's financial district, it was busy with workers stepping out for a late lunch break, heading for meetings, or maybe leaving work for the day. At one of the city's biggest and busiest skyscrapers, 101 California Street, it was no different. The building was home to many law and financial firms, and according to a report, several hundred people filed in and out of the building every day. That is why the city and the surrounding area were shaken when a breaking news report came in at around 3:30 p.m. that day and reported that a sniper was roaming the halls of the 101 California building. Police were surrounding the building, and people had been confirmed shot. Reports also state that as news broke, many employees and visitors of the building called into local news to tell them what they were witnessing, including one woman who said management told occupants via a speaker to lock all doors and stay in place. Another man said he had around 30 people in his office, and they too had their doors locked. Some people also called in saying they spoke with loved ones in the building and said they were locked down. As the scene unfolded, news cameras captured the terrifying scene of people coming from the building on stretchers and ambulances racing to the scene to help anyone else who may have been wounded. As hours passed, many San Franciscans who had loved ones in the building waited in agony to learn if their loved one was hurt, or even worse, dead. But when it was around 6 p.m. that day, many were relieved to learn that the gunman of the building had stopped his siege as he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. But for 8 families, they would receive the heartbreaking news that their loved one was murdered, and that the bloodshed was committed by 55-year-old Gianluigi Ferri. According to reports, not many details are known about Gianluigi's early life. But what is known is that his life was filled with many bumpy moments. According to reports, Gianluigi was born in Asmara, Ethiopia in 1937 to parents of Italian descent, and that by the time he was 20, he began working in engineering. He eventually immigrated to the U.S., first to Boston, and then to San Francisco. According to reports, Gianluigi moved around a bit throughout the city before moving again to Santa Rosa, California, then to Petaluma, California, and then back to Santa Rosa. During these years, he was a draftsman for Stanford Oil Company, then a counselor at a children's center, then an instructor at Sonoma State University. Years later, he enrolled at the University of California, Santa Cruz, in 1969, and the same year he married a woman named Donna Jean, in which he became a naturalized citizen after the marriage. However, reports state that sometime during the marriage, Gianluigi became disillusioned with his educated career, and after viewing a church service hosted by prosperity preacher Terry Cole Whitaker one day on TV, Gianluigi felt he could enter the world of the get-rich-quick jobs and be specifically focused on real estate. Gianluigi worked almost night and day to try and find different properties in the area to own and possibly rent out. And he also spent countless hours drafting plans to own other businesses. And possibly due to his obsessive behavior with the businesses, Donna parted ways with him by the late 1970s, and they completely divorced in 1979. This year, though, Gianluigi decided to dabble in business in Las Vegas, and his first business was a mortgage business he named ADF Mortgage, Inc. He also started another business here that was a peculiar one that did nothing but refer calls and mail to his California address for $140 a month. Gianluigi also opened other small businesses throughout California and Vegas, and he had so many that he eventually hired a bookkeeper and a few other employees to keep up with all his accounts and finances. But according to reports, the employees felt Gianluigi was very strange, unnerving, and that he was very private, with one stating, quote-unquote, "You couldn't get anything out of him. He was really secretive." Reports also state that despite his many business deals, Gianluigi was far from successful. Many who worked with him said he never made any real profits, and that many of his business dealings ended with lawsuits after he did not hold up his end of the bargain, as in he did not give the product or dealing he offered. Despite the lawsuits, though, Gianluigi continued to want more and to try his hand at other businesses. Reports state that by 1981, he heard about a 3-mobile home park listing that was for sale near Indianapolis. It's unclear how he found out about the listing, but when he did, Gianluigi was said to have been really excited and thought he could possibly luck up with business in the Midwest, since his businesses weren't doing anything in the West. However, the listing price for the mobile homes was $8 million, which he didn't have. But he knew of some investors from Italy who might have been able to help him. So, he contacted the investors and made a rapport with them, and he persuaded them enough to work with him and the realtor company selling the homes on the mobile home deal. He also contacted a local law firm named Pettit and Martin for advice and help in arranging the deal on his end. And after contacting lawyers here, they agreed to help him. Reports state lawyers at Pettit and Martin advised Gianluigi to figure out how to get at least most of the money for the properties and let the investors handle the rest. According to reports, through much debt, Gianluigi was able to obtain around $6 million of his own for the sale, and the investors gave him $1.9 million for the down payment. However, as luck continued to have it, the deal fell apart due to financial and engineering issues, and inspectors and engineers faulting the plan due to the mobile home parks being located on floodplains. Angry, the investors sued Gianluigi, in which he sued the real estate company, and with the attorneys at Pettit and Martin, they were able to settle Gianluigi's lawsuit with a $1 million settlement, which included $233,000 in cash, in which he used to cover other investments, and Pettit and Martin continued to work with him regarding a land property deal, which also fell through. Eventually, he stopped working with the law firm altogether, but he continued for years to try his hand at real estate to no avail. By the time the 1990s rolled around, Gianluigi still only had business plans with no profits, and by 1992, Gianluigi was flat broke. In October of that year, he tried to file for bankruptcy at a Hollywood, California law firm, but could not afford the fee. It was said, though, that while he was working with the attorneys, he complained about bad business deals and that he was upset he had lost $300,000 in another land deal in Leadville, Colorado, near Aspen. And by 1993, Gianluigi had invested most of the money he had into bad deals, was severely in debt, and by now, he was at his wit's end. Reports state that in January 1993, Gianluigi traveled to Henderson, Nevada to a pawn shop and inquired about guns. And for weeks after, he kept visiting the same pawn shop and asking about a wide array of guns for hours. But he mostly focused on high-powered ones and told the workers that he needed one for protection. Gianluigi went on to buy a used Tech 9, but returned it the same day because he told the clerk he didn't like it and needed a special gun for a very special task. Months later in April, he visited a gun store in Vegas and told the clerk he needed a quote-unquote target practice gun, but ended up buying another Tech 9, and a month later, he bought another Tech 9 at a gun show. On June 18, 1993, Gianluigi went with one of the few friends he had on a target shooting trip where he shot with one of his recently purchased guns. Then on June 25th, he purchased a pistol back in Henderson. And according to reports, as the weeks went on until July 1st, Gianluigi kept practicing with his guns and wrote nonstop about things and people that made him angry and that he wanted revenge. On the morning of July 1st, 1993, reports state Gianluigi drove to San Francisco and talked briefly with staff at Pettit & Martin at the 101 California building. He then left but returned later that afternoon. At around 2:45 p.m., a worker in the building noticed Gianluigi, who was dressed in a business suit and suspenders, pulling a luggage cart with two large duffel bags on them in the lobby of the building. He then rolled past three security guards at the front lobby desk and then took an elevator to the 34th floor. The offices of Pettit & Martin were housed on this floor, as well as the 33rd and 35th floors. And when he arrived, a legal secretary for the firm came across him in the elevator lobby, and she noticed he was fumbling with one of the duffel bags. When she asked him if he needed help, Gianluigi told her to quote-unquote, wait right there. As she waited, though, she noticed his handgun and thought he was a thief and thought he may ask her for her purse. But Gianluigi just told her to keep waiting. But then he pulled the red lever disabling the elevator and then made his way to the conference room on the same floor. The legal secretary then alerted the 34th floor receptionist about the man with the gun, and they both went to another department to warn employees about Gianluigi. Another employee near the elevator lobby saw him and the gun as well, and slipped into an accounting department room and warned them about him. When Gianluigi got to the conference room, inside was 30-year-old Jody Jones Posado, a married mother of a 10-month-old baby. She was at Pettit & Martin for an arbitration proceeding for a wrongful termination and sexual discrimination suit against a company being represented by Pettit & Martin. Also with Jody was her attorney, 36-year-old Jack Berman, who is specifically an employment attorney with firm Bronson, Bronson & McKinnon, as well as 35-year-old Sharon O'Rourke, who was a counsel for Electronic Data Systems, the company who Jody was suing. Lastly, 33-year-old Deanna Eves sat in the room as the court reporter for the case. When suddenly, the glass windows to the conference room shattered after a blast. Gianluigi had shot at them and then went inside. Once the occupants realized what was going on, they tried to scurry under tables to safety. But then Gianluigi shot and killed both Jack Berman and Jody Sposato, and then severely injured Deanna and Sharon. He then exited the room, turned to his right, and made his way down a hallway. He came across 52-year-old law partner Alan Burke and his colleague, 39-year-old litigation attorney Brian Berger, chatting in Allen's office. He then shot the glass surrounding Allen's office and then shot the men with his pistol, killing Allen and severely wounding Brian. He continued on near the office's interior staircase and came across 30-year-old Pettin & Martin summer intern David Sutcliffe. Gianluigi shot and killed him instantly. Then he came across contract attorney 42-year-old Charles Ross and shot him as well, but he survived. By this point, many in the building were aware of the shootings and emergency personnel had been called. Reports state that police cars arrived in droves just minutes after 911 was called, and they made their way inside the building. However, despite being aware police were approaching, Gianluigi wasn't finished. As he was leaving the staircase, he came across married couple 27-year-old Michelle Scully and her husband 28-year-old John, who had only been married for about 9 months, and they were both attorneys at the firm. Reports state that Michelle's office was on the 33rd floor and John's on the 34th. And sometime that day, she told John she wanted to go to the local university to do some research, but he persuaded her to stay instead and spend some time with him working in his office. She agreed, and as she was gathering her work to bring to John's office, John ran into her office and told her that someone was in the building shooting. She told him she thought she heard popping, but thought it was a 4th of July fireworks prank. But they both fled to try to get to safety. However, as they made their way to the staircase and came across Gianluigi, there was no more hope for safety. So John threw his body over Michelle to try and protect her from what was coming. When he did, though, Gianluigi mortally wounded him and wounded Michelle, then left. However, even though they were both still alive, John knew he was not going to live and reportedly told Michelle, quote-unquote, "I'm dying. I love you." And then he took his last breath. As security guards throughout the building tried to work with police officers and usher as many as they could to safety, Gianluigi continued his massacre and made his way down the staircase to the 32nd floor. He came across the financial firm Trust Company of the West and law firm Davis Wright & Tremaine. Reports state both firms had large lockable wooden doors, but despite the commotion at 101 California, none of the workers had been notified of the dangerous gunmen lurking on the floors. After reaching the 32nd floor, Gianluigi entered the lobby for Trust Company of the West, where he reloaded his weapons. The lobby was empty, but surrounded by offices, and reports state that although the office of 48-year-old Trust Company employee Donald, nicknamed Mike Merrill, sat in plain view of the lobby, he didn't see Gianluigi. But when Gianluigi spotted Mike, he shot and killed him, then made his way throughout the firm. He shot and killed 64-year-old secretary Shirley Mooser. Then he made his way to Davis Wright & Tremaine and came across 33-year-old legal secretary Deborah Fogle, and shot and killed her as well. After this, Gianluigi planned to spread his carnage to other floors, but reports state that when he descended to the 29th floor, what he wasn't expecting was SWAT team members approaching him. And by this point, he knew it was over. So in his last act, he took out his pistol, placed it under his chin, and pulled the trigger. Gianluigi Ferri was now dead, and his terror was over. And in the end, he ended 8 lives, with Brian Berger dying 2 years later and injured many others. Reports state that during the investigation, police found notes on Gianluigi's body that had a list of names of people from Pettit and Martin and other businessmen that he wanted revenge on. But the problem was, none of the victims killed and wounded at Pettit and Martin or the other offices were on the list, meaning to detectives, Gianluigi was just mad at the firm as a whole and didn't care who worked there at the time. They also found on his body a typed letter containing a list of complaints, but it was very illegible. The letter was 4 pages long in single-spaced format and was written in all caps. But eventually, detectives couldn't pinpoint an exact motive for the massacre, and the case was closed. However, relatives of the victims fought for change fast. Reports state that the morning after his wife was killed, Jody Sposato's husband Steve wrote a letter to President Bill Clinton condemning the weapons Gianluigi used, and he and other relatives of the victims decided how they could change gun laws and have more gun control across America. So they almost immediately created a group called the Legal Community Against Violence. And a report states, quote-unquote, they met at the Bar Association of San Francisco and presented their first executive director with the already formed Brady Center to prevent gun violence. The group's most important policy being pushed by activists was a ban on the sorts of guns Gianluigi used, such as weapons with high-capacity magazines and military-esque features that they deemed didn't serve any practical purpose. With Steve Sposato going in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee during an August 1993 hearing, with he and Jody's baby girl on his back in her carrier, asking the question, quote-unquote, can any of you advise me how to tell a 10-month-old baby that mommy's dead? And he continued by saying, perhaps the manufacturer of the Intratech Tech DC-9 assault weapon should publish this information with the instruction manual for its murderous weapon. After the hearing, the group, working with many U.S. politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, pled for several months to ban the weapons, with even then-President Bill Clinton making public appeals for the ban, with living former presidents signing a letter backing the ban around the same time. And on May 5th, 1994, the House voted to pass the ban, and the measure was folded into a bigger crime bill that also built new prisons, hired more police officers, and imposed harsher penalties on criminals, among other things, even if the bill ended up becoming flawed and controversial in later years, with some saying such things like the bill wouldn't stop the purchase of the military-style guns to residents, and with some praising the bill as it turned tragedy to victory for many family members of victims of gun violence. In the years after the tragedy, many families of the 101 California Massacre, along with other members of the group, gathered each year to remember their loved ones. With one member telling the press back in 2018, quote-unquote, I think a big reason for that is the 101 California Street shooting still matters to people here. They haven't forgotten, and they know we came out of that. Even though I know a lot of people outside of California may not remember it, or it may not be that big of a deal here, it still really matters to people. Most people who've been in this city a long time still tell me they walk by the building and think of it. The story of the 101 California Street Massacre comes from the sources of the San Francisco Examiner, Vice News, Mercury News, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, so I'm not going to do an opinion piece on this episode. I'm trying not to do an opinion piece on every episode for season 6, but I do just have one question, and I know that the 90s was a different time, but I do wonder, like, the reports state the security guards at 101 California saw Gianluigi with a luggage cart and two large duffel bags. And I know it's different times. Maybe they just minded their business back then or didn't have strenuous security measures. But I guess nowadays in 2025, more than likely, if you saw someone with a luggage cart going into a high-rise building or any type of important building or something like that with a luggage cart and two large duffel bags, I can guarantee you more than likely they are going to be searched. That bag is going to be searched and hopefully, you know, they're not going to be injured or shot. But again, this is a tragedy. But that was one thing I just wondered, like, what were the security guards thinking about when they saw, or maybe they didn't see, but if they did see Gianluigi with the large bags on the luggage cart, like, they just thought it was okay and let him go to the elevator? Like, wow. But I digress. But that's it. I would like to know, by the way, what do you all think of this case? If you follow me on Instagram, I'm going to put a preview up about the case. And you can leave a comment there if you'd like to comment on this case. But that's it. Thank you for tuning in to this brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And I hope you found this case interesting. If you like what you've heard and haven't done so, I would love for you to leave a rating and a review if the platform you listen to podcasts has a rating system or review system. You can also, like I mentioned earlier, read 90s cases from 90s Crime Time on 90s Crime Time on Instagram, primarily on the weekends. There'll be one released tonight, Thursday, January 16th. So if you haven't followed, you can tonight, just so you can look at the post I have for you. Well, for you all that follow later on. And with that, stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.